You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of April, 2014, right here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London with me, Tyler Brûlé, coming up on today's show.
I think it's unusual for a president to make this kind of declaration while an investigation is ongoing. This is, I think, her way to say, hey, look, guys, we've done all that we can, but the true culprits are the crew aboard that ship.
Korea's Sewol ferry disaster, fears of the unraveling Ukraine-Russia deal, and Obama's trip to Asia. Dr. James Boyes and John Everard will join me to discuss the day's biggest stories. Then, lightening the mood, we'll hear from Dan Sujic, director of London's Design Museum and author of the new book, B is for Bauhaus.
It's 30 or 40 musings on everything from why I wear a parka to the terrible embarrassment of my family. So it's a look at various aspects of design through a personal perspective.
All that, plus our Athens correspondent, Natalie Savarakis, wraps up the day's news from Greece, and of course, we'll be staying in the Eastern Mediterranean for a check in all things cultural in Istanbul. That's Midori House with me, Tyler Brûlé, starting right now. So, a lot to get through over the next 59 minutes. First, though, the world news with Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. South Korea's president has condemned the conduct of some of the crew of the ferry that sank last week, calling it akin to murder. Ms. Park Geun-hye says those to blame will have to take criminal and civil responsibility for their actions. Divers are still recovering bodies from the MV Sewol. The latest death toll is 64, with 238 people missing. Most victims are students who are on a school trip. Russia's foreign minister is accusing Ukraine of violating an agreement reached in Geneva last week aimed at averting a wider conflict. Sergei Lavrov says the Kiev government, which is not recognized by Moscow, has made no moves to disarm illegal groups, especially the ultra-nationalist right sector. He's also condemned Sunday's fatal shooting near Slovyansk in eastern Ukraine. Meanwhile, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe has had a two-hour meeting with one of the leaders of the pro-Russian separatists. Senior OSCE mediator in eastern Ukraine, Mark Etherington, described what he and Vyacheslav Ponomaryov talked about.
We discussed four issues. Whether he and the groups he leads would comply with the provisions of the Geneva Statement. The whereabouts and circumstances of detainees, including former Mayor Stepa, the alleged maltreatment of the Roma minority in Slovyansk, and the shooting incident in the town of the 20th of April. We'll today report what we have seen and heard to the 57 participating states of the OSCE. These, of course, include all the parties to the Geneva Statement.
Chinese family members of passengers aboard missing flight MH370 have been protesting during a meeting with Malaysian representatives. Several hundred relatives have attended the meeting at the hotel in Beijing, where they've been gathering since the plane disappeared on March the 8th. They chanted slogans at the representatives, who included an envoy from the Malaysian embassy, and they demanded to see technical experts. Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 went missing an hour into its flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. Of the 239 people on board, 154 were Chinese. Since the flight disappeared, many relatives have accused Malaysian authorities of withholding information. Nepal's Sherpas have demanded compensation of $10,000 for the families of 16 colleagues dead or missing after last week's avalanche on Mount Everest. They also want double the insurance cover for expeditions on the world's highest mountain. The government has announced an immediate payment of $400 to the victims' families to cover funeral costs. At least 13 guides were killed, three are missing, and at least three others are having intensive care for broken limbs, ribs, blood clots and other injuries. Thousands of marathon runners have taken to the streets of Boston, 1 year after three people were killed and more than 260 injured in a bomb attack. A moment of silence was held before around 36,000 runners set off, 9,000 more than usual. Officials have mounted a huge security operation that includes a ban on rucksacks and screening at checkpoints. US runner Meb Keflezighi won the men's race, and Rita Jeptu from Kenya won the women's. Several hundred thousand people have been watching from the sidelines. These spectators hope it's a trouble-free event.
I think it's great. I happen to believe those that say it's the safest place on the planet today.
The number of people and from all the different countries that are going to be running and the visitors in town, it makes it a really exciting time to be here.
A lot more security. And if you've paid any attention to what's happened over the last year, if you have any interest in running, this is where you want to be today.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Bill. More from you in about 25 minutes. Time we'll see you back down here at Studio One. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's just a 2:06 if you're listening in Tokyo, 18:06 here in London, it's 13:06 in New York. As I said a little earlier, joining me in the studio with their take on the day's news is Dr. James Boyce, American political historian, and John Everard, a frequent cyclist to our little courtyard here, former British ambassador as well to North Korea and a couple of other outposts as well. Gentlemen, welcome. I hope this Easter Monday has been good to you so far.
Thank you, yes.
Good to see you. Thank you.
Very good to see you. We'll probably pick up where we were with the bulletin on the Ukraine. Of course, the shooting just after midnight in Slavyansk. Many saying this is, could pretty much derail everything that we've seen. So far, reports are saying the firefight took place at a checkpoint. It left at least five dead and, of course, spurring perhaps predictable accusations from both sides. That, of course, one or the other was responsible. James, I want to start with you. Beyond the corridors of Geneva, but all of the other sort of key diplomatic centers involved in this. Do you think this will be, there's an ability to isolate this or not at this point?
It'd be very difficult to see how this plays out. There seems to be a real sense here that Moscow and Washington are talking very, very different language. There's a real sense, I think, that Moscow seems to be looking at this saying, well, it's nothing to do with us. This is all the United States provocation behind the scenes, trying to sit in the middle and look at this. It's very difficult to see how that plays out, quite frankly. And this is something going on the ground that we don't know about at this point. And there's clearly an awful lot of provocation coming out of Moscow at this point, I think. Whether this is going to derail the Geneva situation, it certainly won't help, let's put it that way.
Mm. I guess from your side, John, if you look at a situation like Slavyansk and certainly, from the side of Washington, also the side of Moscow, I'm just sort of curious from diplomatic sort of corridors. Do you think we're going to see another sort of strong voice emerge in terms of, let's say, a voice of reason in terms of mediation amidst all of this? I mean, everyone is just saying, could someone, please stand up and perhaps take either a harder line or a little bit more responsible leadership, at least from the side of the West?
I don't think we're going to see much by way of mediation. Nobody seems to want to get themselves in the middle of this lot.
Mm.
I think there's a very strong chance that we're going to see a much stronger line coming out of the West. The reason that the Geneva Accord was signed was that effectively the West put a pistol to Putin's head and warned him that if he didn't back down, he was going to be in deep trouble. And I think there's every chance now that with the Geneva Accord sliding into obscurity, that is exactly what's going to happen.
Mm.
We look at the rival claims of Moscow and Washington. I think the big difference is that Washington has now, talked about has produced the photographs of the people involved, showing that, in fact, the same people are going around stirring trouble in eastern Ukraine as were involved in Crimea, as were involved in Georgia. And, of course, as the Ukrainians rightly have pointed out, there are large elements of the Russian version of what happens to Slavyansk that are completely absurd. I mean, finding the business card of one of the heads of Pravi Sektor on the car, which was completely burnt out, everything burnt apart from the business card, of course, it stresses credulity.
Absolutely. Sorry, James.
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, the more you look at this, the more you realise just how absurd Putin's position seems to be on this. The question is, what is the West going to do about it? You know, we talk about diplomacy. Is that going to have any impact? Well, so far, Putin, I think, would look at the situation and say, well, you know, South Ossetia worked out quite well in his favour. So far, if you look at what's happened with regard to Crimea, that's worked out quite well in his favour. It's difficult to see how this is going to resolve itself in terms of diplomatic niceties at this point.
Mm. I don't think we're talking diplomatic niceties. I think that basically the situation is that Putin is weak but agile. He has to move fast to keep momentum going. And remember, we've had this trouble in eastern Ukraine now for the best part of a week. The momentum is slowing, and quite clearly the operation there has gone badly wrong for him. On the other hand, the West moves much more slowly. In the West, you have to build consensus. You have to get a lot of the border states on board before you can do anything. But essentially, the West has all the cards. We can kill Russia by slow strangulation if we want to. And there's every indication that's precisely what Obama has in mind.
So what, from your perspective, John, comes next then? I mean, you know, you only have to sort of, you know, certainly look at the papers over the last, you know, 72 hours. You see the banks all over the world becoming much more cautious. I mean, we'll talk about Asia a little bit later. I mean, FT sort of leading on the fact that Japan's banks, you know, very, very slow now on and I mean, really sort of, you know, almost demobilizing in their Moscow offices at the moment. So is that sort of the slow move that we start to see right now?
Yes, and that is what happens even before we announce economic sanctions. That is just the threat of economic sanctions. If the West started to get hard on Russia, I mean, it's not difficult to bring the stuttering Russian economy to a grinding halt, which would cause Putin all kinds of difficulties. What happens next, you ask me? I think, firstly, it's possible that Putin will simply try to keep the situation bubbling for a bit. He hasn't got what he wanted in eastern Ukraine. Notably, I mean, we all talk about where he is. Look at where he isn't. His operation to try to gain Kharkiv has failed miserably. The big one has eluded him. Only in Slavyansk do his people, and let's not kid ourselves that these are independent separatists, do his people actually have control of the town. In Donetsk and Luhansk, they're there, but they're holed up in the government building. They don't actually control much outside that. And quite soon he's going to get into trouble supplying these people with the basics, not alone arming them. So he may want to attempt to, you know, further takeovers. I think he's been rather sort of shaken by the strength of the Ukrainian reaction. He wasn't expecting pushback. The pushback wasn't great, I grant you, but there was actually pushback. That's one possibility. The other is, and you know, heaven forfend this, that he actually does move troops across the border. Now, if he does that, I think all bets are off. Mm-hmm. We are looking at a possible war in Europe. Mm. And it's the military experts telling me that the Russian army is a bit of a shambles. It's in the middle of a reorganization. He's going to have to use tracked vehicles to have any kind of impact. He might get 100, maybe 200 kilometers into Ukrainian territory, and then it'll bog down. And you are going to be looking at a bloodbath which will make the Russian occupation of Afghanistan look like a picnic in comparison.
If you're a supreme allied commander at NATO or one of the deputies, I would hope, but are there scenarios that even address this right now, John, or we're not there yet?
NATO is paid to work out scenarios, and one would hope. Well, it does, and I think we can take it as read that a lot of people in NATO HQ have been looking in great detail at contingencies. Mm. We all hope, of course, it doesn't come to that, but I think we can rest assured those plans are in place. Mm.
Maybe for better or for worse, James, we don't have the luxury of getting all of the U.S. morning shows on this side of the Atlantic, but certainly the Sunday morning programs, you know, there would no doubt have been, you know, a lot of talk over the weekend about the position of the Obama administration. Ratings right now, you know, so many people saying that, you know, when is this administration even going to kick into gear? Many, of course, saying a State Department that looks like it's in disarray and not being front-footed enough. How is this playing out in the U.S. right now?
Well, what I can see from it, look at the figures, everything, you look at what's going on in the press and you try and read between the headlines, there's absolutely no public interest in getting involved in this part of the world. Most Americans don't seem to know where this place is. Those who do know where it is don't believe there's any American national interest in getting involved in this. Some 61% of Americans, when polled, disapprove of any direct action involved in this part of the world. So there's no public sentiment behind it. There's no great gathering on Capitol Hill for this. We're moving into an election silly season with the midterms coming up. As soon as they're out of the way, everybody turns to 2016. It's one of the problems you have when you have a system of government which is geared up very much to focus upon campaigning rather than governing, especially one that's very poll-driven like this. There's no doubt people are asking when the Obama administration administration is going to get into high gear. It's in its second term by now. Mm. If it hasn't, can't walk and chew gum at this point, there's a problem. The problem, of course, ultimately, is that your administration is geared up to withdraw from places around the world, Afghanistan, Iraq, and it's essentially not looking to get involved anywhere anytime soon.
Besides which, it doesn't want to. I mean, when he's talking about involvement, you're talking about military involvement. But that's what Putin wants, and the United States are not going to give him that. Putin is looking for some kind of something that will generate heroes, something that will whip up nationalist passion in Russia. Mm-hmm. And I think both Washington and Brussels are being very careful not to play into his hand.
Do you think, John, that Washington has also been looking for more of a proxy on the ally side to take more of a leadership stance? You know, let's say the dialogue and the hotlines between London, Washington, Washington and Brussels, you know, Berlin as well. If I'm sitting in Washington, am I disappointed or happy the way Europe has been playing this so far?
I think you're disappointed at the initial response, but you're getting steadily happier as Europe gets into gear. You're looking for a proxy. If there is a proxy, it's likely to be Berlin. The Germans have been very heavily engaged with this. And one of the things that I think threw Putin right at the beginning was the very harsh language that Angela Merkel used. Not the kind of things that Germans, who are usually very, very conservative, very cautious in diplomatic statements, usually say. And to have her, of all people, come out and say the things she did will have grated, rather.
I'm going to take a very short break. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're going away for a moment, but we're back in about a minute.
The Entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. You're with me, Tyler Burleigh. I'm joined today by Dr. James Boyce, American political historian, and John Everard, Britain's former man in North Korea. And we're going to stay on that peninsula right now because obviously, as you, of course, heard a leading story in our bulletin as well, is, of course, the whole story of the Sewol and the capsizing of this Korean ferry. South Korea's president, Park Geun-hye, has come out. Many have said after a little bit of a dithering, maybe a little bit earlier on, comparing the actions of the crew to murder. This is from our correspondent, Jason Strother, in Seoul a bit earlier.
Since the Seoul sank last Wednesday, it's really been her government that's been the focus of a lot of the anger, not only from the parents of the victims, but also within the populace as well. I think it's unusual for a president to make this kind of declaration while an investigation is ongoing. This is, I think, her way to say, hey, look, guys, we've done all that we can, but the true culprits in this whole ordeal are the crew aboard that ship. We all maybe remember Korea Airlines really had a pretty poor reputation back in the 1990s when planes seemed to be crashing all the time. And, of course, it was unfortunate with the Asiana crash last year in San Francisco. I do think what the Seoul has created here is a concern for safety protocols. I think a lot of Koreans think that too often management companies, they cut corners, they cut costs by overstepping security concerns.
That was our Jason Strother in Seoul. John, don't want to necessarily start with you, but you've spent some time certainly not just on the peninsula, but immersed in Korean culture, I guess, both sides of the border. Now, a lot of people have talked about the story, saying that this is really sort of something which is almost, you know, endemic. We've seen this in cockpits. We've now seen this on the bridge of ships. You know, this might just be a mistake. It might also be this issue of not challenging your senior officer, not bothering him when he might be off the bridge, not bothering your captain of your aircraft if he might be in the loo, and things are going wrong. So it's amazing to sort of hear the language, of course, of Park Geun-hye, you know, immediately sort of, you know, calling this murder while an investigation's going on. How do you view this? Is this the situation of a country which is, you know, growing at an extraordinary pace? Is the teething pains of, you know, infrastructure gone mad? How do you read this?
I don't think it's actually a question of Korean culture. I think this, tragically, is the kind of accident that could have happened in a number of countries. The captain left the bridge briefly, he said. He was entitled to do so. The vessel was not under pilotage. He was not breaking maritime law in doing that. Handed across to a responsible officer who had not navigated that water before. Mm. She makes a fatal mistake. Mm. And the whole thing, clearly from there, if you watch the transcripts, happened very, very fast. Even if she had rushed back and said, "Captain, come back, you know, something's going badly wrong," I don't think that would have saved the situation. He was back on the bridge in any case within moments. Mm. I mean, he didn't hang about.
And Park Geun-hye's statement, you know, we're coming up to, it's almost been, you know, a week at this point, and using this strong language, partly because she doesn't want people looking at her official residence and sort of, you know, rattling on the gates at this point. So better to come out with a hard statement like this right now?
I think, yes, a hard statement. Firstly, we talk about this as if this is a carefully calculated statement. Mm. Park Geun-hye is a passionate and emotional woman. I think she's simply angry. You know, she's watched these people drown, and she is just talking from the heart, as she so often has in the past. If in its political aspect, yes, she wants to make clear that she condemns absolutely what's happened, and she's sending out a very strong signal to everybody that, you know, these mistakes are simply intolerable and that you do not behave that way if you're in charge of a vessel. Mm. I'm sure that other ferry pilots will be taking very careful note.
I was talking to the former CEO of, a major European carrier and also Asian carrier, James, and they were saying it's not a great time for transport brands, even national brands in Asia at the moment. We, of course, look at the situation a little further south in Kuala Lumpur, how the Malaysian government has dealt, certainly with the MH's missing aircraft. And at the same time, a lot of people said, not a great time for Korea either, you know, and John, I guess, depending how you sort of observe this, but also, you know, until the Malaysian missing aircraft incident, there's also now the NTSB official report coming out on that Asiana flight that, again, pilot error, this you know, 777, the first fatality of 777 flown into a runway in San Francisco, you know, on a sunny day without wind. Does this damage a national brand, do you think? Do people think twice about whether it's investment, their relations, when you see things like this happen?
Well, it certainly doesn't help in any way, does it? I mean, if one wants to travel in that part of the world now, one has to wonder, well, what's the best way of doing it? If the air travel's out of whack, if going on the sea is problematic, you know, how does one get around in that part of the world? And there's no doubt, I think, that it's very, very troubling when you see maritime vessels going down, aircraft coming down. We have to sort of step back and say, well, you know, Is this endemic, or is it just a number of very unfortunate incidents which happen to be occurring at the very same time period? I think there's no mistake that what you're seeing this weekend is a political dimension playing out, trying to push any blame away from the administration on towards the actual maritime people responsible for this. What this is going to have happen, again, are you agreeing with what John was saying? The way in which this is going to play out in terms of perspectives on that part of the world will be very, very interesting to see. Mm. I think.
John, sorry.
No, I was nodding in agreement.
I thought you had to use a razor sharp comment to come in on that one. I want to. We have Mr. Obama arriving in Tokyo quite soon on the part of a four nation tour. Just on this note, and I just want to go back to, you know, what could be sort of, some have seen it as sort of a great coming together. Many people said, you know, off the back of the, so far, the Malaysia tragedy, that tragedy aside, that this was quite good that you saw all of these nations that are banding together for this search. I mean, do you think that's played out that way? Or is it, you know, in a way also sort of slightly also then been co-opted by the United States? Yeah. You know, every time you sort of listen to CNN, it's on an Australian ship, you know, with a US search vessel on board, and it seems a little bit sort of hijacked in a way. And I'm wondering how this looks for the region.
Yeah, it's interesting because obviously, you know, Malaysia took the lead on this to start with, it would appear, and there's an awful lot of people who go rather unhappy with that very, very quickly. And you seem to sense that the Americans are moving in very quickly. The degree to which the Chinese role in this is quite interesting as well. The suggestion that the Chinese are putting out one line and another, and is the data that's coming out of Beijing accurate or not, I think is quite telling. I think there's an awful lot of people in Washington who won't be happy with this unless it's absolutely run out of the NTSB. Now, whether there's a racial element to this is very interesting. One can't always gauge that, of course. But in terms of the expertise here, you know, maybe the Americans are the best people to take the lead on this.
Absolutely not. I mean, I think the Australians have actually they've shown that they're actually rather better at it. There is a deep belief in Washington that only Americans can do things. It's just something that the United States has to be weaned away from slowly and painfully.
And on that note, I was talking to a diplomat just because, of course, Mr. Obama will be going to Korea, will be going to the Philippines as well on this tour. One interesting thing, someone said that this there could have been an opportunity here because, you know, Japan came out very quickly. And of course, we know what the answer would be. And the answer was thus, Japan said, we will send assistance to Korea to help with this vessel, etc. Yep. Of course, this was declined through diplomatic back channels. You know, is this the type of thing that, also just holds the region back as well? As much as, Mr. Obama wants to, of course, talk trade, he also wants to, help mend fences as well.
I think, yes, of course, he wants to mend fences. I think the Japanese were making a gesture. They didn't expect it to be accepted. That also, there's a practical point that the Koreans have got all the divers you could possibly want swarming around that vessel. I mean, sort of, they don't need further assistance. They've found ways in. It's just a question now of getting the bodies out and investigating properly. So there's not an operational advantage to bring the Japanese in there. Coming back though to the point about the cooperation over the Malaysia flight, I mean, it's what you got wasn't actually sort of face-to-face cooperation, wasn't sort of great hugs and bonding. They simply carved out different areas the different countries got to go and search in, and the crews hardly met each other. I mean, I'd love to be able to argue that it brought Asian nations together, but realistically, I don't think it did.
I want to just go to, and we'll stay on the Obama tour right now. Daniel Twining, writing in the Nikkei Asian Review, talks about Asia's pivot to America. He just starts off, he says, when U.S. President Barack Obama launches his four-country Asian trip in Japan on the 23rd, his main priority will be to reassure anxious allies that there will be no Asian equivalent of what we've just seen in Crimea, just as no European nation wants to be part of a new Russian empire, no Asian nation wants to forfeit its independence to a new Middle Kingdom.
Yes, that's right. Now, he's, of course, Japan and South Korea are already close allies, as are the Philippines, who also have disputes with China. I think there might be some quite interesting conversations in Kuala Lumpur on this. Malaysia must be watching what's going on with deep nervousness. This tour doesn't take in Vietnam. With, of course, the history, as they say, between Vietnam and the United States. But given what's going on, people in Hanoi must also be wondering whether the time has come to reach out to Washington and to try to work something out to protect Vietnam against possible Chinese incursions.
Do you think that this, obviously this started off as very much a mission for the trade partnership,
sure.
But has it slightly been, again, or will it be overshadowed by what but Mr. Twining is writing in the Asia Review?
Well, I think it's one of these interesting things. Obama was, of course, meant to be in this part of the world at the back end of last year, and he cancelled it relatively late in the day for various reasons. Now he's going back. Of course, it's about events, isn't it, the usual line. He's going at a time when there's obviously these issues to do with the ship going down, with the aircraft missing. The trade issues need to be coming through. One of the great problems, of course, is that no matter what he negotiates in this part of the world in terms of trade, he's still got to get it to the United States Senate, for example, which is no given, quite frankly, with regard to the situation, with regard to the fast-track trading authority situation. So whilst there's no doubt that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is very much at the heart of his aspirations, there's all sorts of great questions about, well, what are Asians thinking about this? Because we in Europe, of course, have looked at this and thought, well, this is a pivot away from Europe, but necessarily in Asia, there's not, I think, a great sense of overjoyment about what it is that this administration has actually done, per se, as opposed to what it's actually talked about with regard to Asia.
I think go ahead, John.
Obama really needs, he's got a hard sell here. The Japanese in particular are starting to get nervous about the security that America offers them, and he's really going to have to soothe a lot of nerves. Things are bad in Japan. I mean, Japan has just posted the worst ever trade deficit, and we've just seen the Chinese seize a Japanese vessel by way of reparations, which had never happened before. So the temperature is rising all the time. And these guys want to know that if the dominoes start to fall, and there's a real risk they will, that the United States will honor its commitments. Mm. There won't be very much in the public statements. This is the kind of thing that will go through long, probably late night discussions with senior Japanese and, for that matter, Korean leaders, and will not be referred to in public. Mm. It'll be a while before we discover how far Obama actually managed to reassure his allies.
I think that no matter whatever happens, it can't go as badly as George H.W. Bush's trip in 1992 when he was unfortunately sick in the lap of the Japanese emperor.
Yes, that's right. There are depths to which Obama simply will not sink.
On another occasion, we're going to have to come back to John because we wanted to know what happened to the auntie of Kim Jong-un, but who somehow sort of disappeared from official documentaries, it seems. But,
yes, that's right. Kim Kyung-hee may well simply have died. She's a very sick old hag. And it's a very bad-tempered old person, and her demise will not be so widely lamented. She was, of course, the wife of Jang Song-taek, who's purged, which won't have helped her at all. And I suspect that her removal from documentaries is simply Kim Jong-un saying, that's it, that whole part of my past, behind the Guardians, has been wiped out.
Better viewing moving forward. Gentlemen, we're going to have to leave it there. Dr. James Boyce and John Everett always telling it like it is here on Midori House. Cheers. Stay with us.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Op Londen, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
It's just gone 18:31 here in London. Plenty still to come on the second half of Midori House. Natalie Savarakis will wrap up the day's news in Greece. We discuss the new book, B is for Bauhaus, and we review the week's art exhibitions in Istanbul. But I'm happy to say that Mr. Bill Bingham is back with the bottom of the hour headlines.
South Korea's president has condemned the conduct of some of the crew of the ferry that sank last week, calling it akin to murder. Ms. Park Geun-hye says those to blame will have to take criminal and civil responsibility for their actions. Divers are still recovering bodies from the MV Sewol. The latest death toll is 64, with 238 people missing. Russia's foreign minister is accusing Ukraine of violating an agreement reached in Geneva last week, aimed at averting a wider conflict. Sergei Lavrov says the Kiev government, which is not recognized by Moscow, has made no moves to disarm illegal groups, especially the ultra-nationalist right sector. Chinese family members of passengers aboard missing flight MH370 have been protesting during a meeting with Malaysian representatives. Several hundred relatives have gathered at the hotel in Beijing, where they've been since the plane disappeared on March the 8th. They chanted slogans at the representatives, who included an envoy from the Malaysian embassy, and they demanded to see technical experts. Nepal's Sherpas have demanded compensation of $10,000 for the families of 16 colleagues dead or missing after last week's avalanche on Mount Everest. They also want double the insurance cover for expeditions on the world's highest mountain. The government has announced an immediate payment of $400 to the victims' families to cover funeral costs. Thousands of marathon runners have taken to the streets of Boston 1 year after three people were killed and more than 260 injured in a bomb attack. A moment of silence was held before around 36,000 runners set off, 9,000 more than usual. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Bill, and you're with our listeners right up until midnight before we hand over to our friends in Australia at the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. You're listening to Midori House. It's 18:33 here in London. It's now time to check in with one of our correspondents from around the world, and today we explore the day's stories in Greece, but we don't have to jump to Athens because our correspondent Natalie Savarakis joins us right here in studio in London. Welcome.
Great to be here.
Let's start. I guess one of the stories which has really fascinated me is a nation which has completely demobilized its state broadcaster. You've had an interim state broadcaster, and now you have a new state broadcaster which is going to be launching. So, for listeners who aren't familiar with the broadcasting scene in Greece, what has happened? Because I'm sure if you're Australian, if you're Canadian or British, you can't sort of imagine what life would be like without your news at 10 or the CBC National or whatever it may have been. What happened? And did sort of the lights officially go off, or did people just move into another building to a broadcaster with a different logo and name?
Well, all of this, if you like.
And now, more.
Exactly. all very Greek. Listen, what happened is in June 2013, what we had was essentially the government pulled the plug on ERT, which was the state broadcaster, and all the TV and radio channels that came with it. They said it was because of budget cuts. That, of course, created a huge international condemnation and backlash, and prompting the government to move quite fast. And they set up this interim broadcaster called, very easily, public television. They didn't go very far for that one. anyway, so in the interim, they've been trying to hire people and to really reset up the whole broadcasting scene in Greece. And what we're expecting is, in a week's time, apparently, the new state broadcaster with the news at six, if you like, will launch. And in May, we'll have the second broadcaster TV channel, of course, which will deal with the peripheral, like, if you like, around Athens, etc. Mm. Of course, all this is met with a lot of suspicion from all the media in Greece, and of course, the unions, who are just wondering if this will be able to, you know, be effective in any way.
I mean, in the absence of a, let's say, muscular, well-funded state broadcaster, have you seen a situation where a private sector player has really sort of stepped into the breach and has really become the respective? Because also, you know, there are some quite powerful, let's say, pan-regional players. You've got Greek companies, have got investments, all the way, certainly through the former Yugoslavia, et cetera, into Bulgaria, et cetera. So have you seen those types of more powerful Greek players taking the role of the state broadcaster?
Well, you've nailed it in a way that the fact that Greece's media scene, and especially the news scene, has been very much dominated by all these, if you like, to use a stronger term, oligarchs, the Greek oligarchs, if you like, who have used it as tools to influence public opinion and influence the political scene as well. No, we haven't seen any of them to be able to dominate this and take the role of ERT, because they themselves have been suffering because of the crisis. So they didn't have the relevant clout, if you like, to come in, and also have been dealt with a lot of met with a lot of suspicion by Greeks themselves, who have always been criticizing the media for intervening, for trying to influence public opinion, etc.
Now, this might have been a story maybe if there was enough of a news gathering budget, but it was a weekend of injuries because it seems that Greek Orthodox, have maybe a few dangerous practices when it certainly comes to celebrating what many would argue is the most holiest of Christian holidays.
Yeah, it's been quite feisty, if you like. The Greeks have two traditions which are quite dangerous. One is balomata, which is essentially in the island of Crete, where whenever they get excited over a celebration or etc., the men, after having a few drinks of tsipouro, which is the Greek arak, start firing their guns.
This seems to be a regional problem, though. I mean, it's yes. Not just confined to Greece. I mean, anyone who spent time in Lebanon.
They're the vestiges of the Ottoman Empire. Yeah. I mean, I don't know the way to celebrate.
Yeah.
Anyway, so one of the men fired the gun during like after the Saturday Mass, and one young football player died because of that, and another one was seriously injured. And of course, on the island of Santorini, we had the other very, again, fiery ritual, which is varelota, which is essentially homemade either firecrackers, the milder version, or rockets, really, which they use to, again, express their joy and, enthusiasm over the Easter Mass.
Mm. Before we go, we're going to be heading to Istanbul in a moment to talk to our Caleb Lauer there about all things cultural. But something has been also happening in Athens at the Onassis Cultural Center as well. Nice little segue for us.
It's the street art scene, if you like, that is being a bit gentrified, if you will. I mean, they're using it Now, the 40 artists have been commissioned by the Onassis Cultural Center to display their work, their graffiti art.
These are proper commissions. These have not been sort of, you know, drilled out of and lifted out of walls, etc. This is, you know, I mean, really the deployment of funds from the cultural center to rally around these artists and get them to do something.
Indeed. And usually what we see these artists using their spray paints, sprays to really illustrate and vent their anger, frustration over the social crisis for the past few years. Mm-hmm. And now they're actually being commissioned to display all this work on the murals of the Onassis Cultural Foundation. It makes a pretty interesting and colourful art scene there.
Great. And Adelaide Savarakis, our Athens correspondent here in London. I guess we should probably let you head for your flight. Thank you very much for joining us. Up next, Dejan Sujic will be discussing his new book, B is for Bauhaus. Stay with us.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock, whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Studio One here at Midori House. It's just gone 2:40. In Tokyo, it is 19:40 if you're listening in Paris, 18:40 here in London. Dejan Sujic has found time while director of the Design Museum here in London to pen something of a delight for those interested in design. He's in good company. His new book, B is for Bauhaus, is a dictionary come autobiography that muses its way through the alphabet, exploring the personal significance of such ideas as authenticity, functional, and creations like Zips. He told Monocle's Ala John how and why he penned this intriguing work.
I guess a good place to begin is to ask, why do this book?
About 6 years ago, when I first started work at the Design Museum, Penguin gave me a two-book deal, the second of which was to write a dictionary of design. And of course, I got the advance and didn't hear anything about it for a year or two. And then I got a phone call from Penguin saying, well, of course, no one buys dictionaries anymore. You can keep the money, but do something else. And so it's turned into, from being a dictionary, into something which has got an A to Z format. But it's 30 or 40 musings on everything from why I wear a parka to the terrible embarrassment of my family, to the nature of fashion. I'm fascinated by YouTube, by Grand Theft Auto. So it's a look at various aspects of design through a personal perspective. I think a lot of journalists aren't very comfortable with using the word I too much, and this is quite an I book.
It is indeed. That is one point I'd like to look at if we could. Why did you take such a personal stance on it? These are your musings, as it were. Do they have to come from that kind of personal, first-person narrative?
Certainly not, but I think if you go to places, meet people, some of the thoughts rub off. But I think also design is a subject which could be seen as simply talking about shape and form, and I've always thought that it's rather important to tell stories, to animate things, to show how something is made, who uses it, and why it matters.
It definitely adds a layer of, I guess, authenticity. Funny, because your first letter in the book is A for Authentic. It begins with a lovely little anecdote, as you said before, you mentioned it, the Green Parker story. Why don't you tell us, we can begin looking into the book by broaching that first, if we could.
I found myself in a Milan side street, wandering into a shop which was selling war surplus. And there on a rack was this amazing green parka, which had obviously been worn by two or three people before me. And I wanted to buy it. It wasn't because I wanted to pretend to be a mod, although I did grow up in the same London suburb as The Who. It was that was something very seductive about a garment which is not trying to be seductive. It's that sense of quality that comes from doing things for performance. So it's got this fantastic brass zip, which no fashion retailer could ever afford to use. The cuffs are held in place by webbing. There were chip buttons. There's a name tag. There's not a maker's label. It's a set of instructions. How could you not want to have such a thing?
But the idea of authenticity is something you go into as well. Just to paraphrase the book, you say it's an irresistible combination of sincerity with authority, qualities that are hard to define, but grasping them is essential to an understanding of the nature of design.
And then designers lovingly fake that sense of authenticity. If you're sitting in the Delaunay, a fantastic restaurant, you can for a moment dream that you are actually in the Vienna of 1900, talking philosophy with famous architects, or looking at literature. Of course, you're not. You're talking about what was on the telly last night. It's that sense, though, of you're trying to live in a world which seems real, but which isn't necessarily real. And in some ways, that's always the dichotomy of design, which has got these two poles. On the one end, it's about trying to make the world a better place. On the other hand, it's about trying to seduce us into buying stuff we don't necessarily need.
Such a big topic to get into. We don't have enough time to do so, but let's begin perhaps by looking at the range of issues that you muse upon. As you said at the top of the interview, you talk about the Xbox, Grand Theft Auto, Zips, authenticity, functionality. How did you pluck these ideas for the book?
I'll tell you, X is for Xerox is a tough one, but luckily I discovered that Xerox and Kodak both came from the small same town in upstate New York. I think what really got me going was N is for National Identity, and I think that's really the most personal. It's thinking about what got me interested in design in the first place. And I think it's partly to do with the realization that my parents came to Britain in the 1930s. My father was actually born an American citizen. My grandfather died when my father was very young. He went back to what was then Austro-Hungary, which became Yugoslavia. He became British. In his life, he could have had six different passports, which always gave me the sense that national identity is somehow rather provisional. It's manufactured. It's manufactured by how banknotes look. I remember being rather surprised when going to Yugoslavia as a kid. Banknotes had these pictures of workers and peasants and power stations. Money, I knew perfectly well, had the Queen on it and men with wigs. Passports in Yugoslavia were red with communist insignia. Here, at that time, they were blue and gold. Design is something which is used to manufacture these senses of these things. And I think that deep down is why I've always been fascinated by trying to understand how design is used to send a message, to send a signal.
It's a wonderful chapter, actually. And as you mentioned, you describe national identity as provisional but utterly compelling. Why were you compelled to it? Is it that sense of a kind of non-linear narrative of identities that you may have or that your parents may have? You yourself grew up in Acton, West London, whereas your parents, well, your dad had multifarious identities perhaps, but they grew up for a time in Belgrade and then changed location.
People do make assumptions based on the signals which can be designed. I remember I was in Glasgow when the Scottish referendum for a Scottish Parliament came through, and I got called by the Scotsman's news desk and asked, "Mr. Sujic, as a prominent Englishman working in Scotland, have you experienced any examples of racial prejudice since you've been here?" Which is a fascinating question to be asked. I mean, Sujic is not necessarily the most English of names. I thought, what do you mean we, Tonto?
Dan Sujic, author of B is for Bauhaus and director of London's Design Museum, in conversation with our Alad John. His new book is out now. About a little bit of a song right now. This is something from our new revised playlist. It was handpicked by our culture editor, Rob Bound. This is Sweden's Little Dragon with Paris. And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, where we're fast approaching the end of the show. But before we go, it's time for our daily review of the week's books, art, music, film. You get the idea. Today, we're going to talk art and exhibitions with our Caleb Lauer, our contributor in Istanbul. Hello, Caleb.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Easter was good to you?
Easter was very good, of course, yes. In a Muslim country, it's not much of an event, but still I managed to take a tour of the various churches down in Karakoy. They have a lot of old Orthodox churches there, so it was very nice.
I do have to ask, though, just in the interest of consumerism, does the Easter Bunny still pay a visit? Because, of course, no great trading nation can say goodbye to all of those chocolate sales. And, of course, we do know that Godiva is also owned by a significant Turkish interest as well.
That's right. We did our part this weekend, I can say.
Let's start with a photo exhibit that you've flagged for us.
Right. This is an exhibition called Başlangıç, which is Inception in Turkish. And this is run by three guys, three friends, photographers. They all knew each other as photographers. They were all loosely affiliated with similar groups. But when they got together, sort of serendipitously, they came together and they realized that they were all taking photos of a similar theme among others in their portfolio. And the similarity was that they were drawn to these black and white, sparse images of natural scenes outside of Istanbul. These are photographers who are on the street regularly every day taking photos of concrete, urban politics, really, really intense stuff. And on their off days, let's say, they were, you know, escaping into the countryside and taking pictures of, you know, these very, very plain scenes with very few people in them. If people do appear, they appear as ants, you know. And when they came together, they said, you know, this has a common enough feel for it that we could put together an exhibition. And so they did. And it was in a very small room upstairs in a apartment near Pera, which is, people will know, is south of Taksim. It's, you know, reference to Agatha Christie's one-time home of the Pera Palace. And, you know, it was a very nice exhibition. And it also, the name Inception comes from the fact that this was the opening of a new photo studio in the same premises, run by Volkan, one of the photographers. And he's one of the founders of Koda Collective, which is a very, very well-known photo agency in Turkey. So it was a nice little side project for them and very, very impressive and a refreshing change from the politics of the day, I should say.
I mean, you say it's non-political, but just, and of course I've not seen the exhibition, but I can only imagine that if, you know, by day a lot of it is looking at the intense urbanism, it is part of the narrative, maybe we don't have to read into it that way, about the great disparity that we see so often in so many emerging economies, you know, the great flight to the city, and then an underfunded, you know, rural class without infrastructure. Is that part of it, or no? Is it simply just a beautiful reportage on life, you know, beyond the city limits?
I would say it's two things, and one of them is very close to what you were saying. There is a political narrative in it, in the sense that it is a reaction to the intense politicization of the day. I mean, when you're in Istanbul working as a documentary photographer, you are intensely involved in politics all the time. To take the time out of your day to showcase something different is a statement in itself. And part of that statement is politics is urban, politics is intense, politics is about concrete. But we forget often that there are villages, countryside, where a lot of people live and a lot of people are being underrepresented by the political narrative of the day.
Why don't we move to another exhibit, which is maybe not highly political, but certainly very political in tone, but also involves off the back of it as well, a series of talks at the same time.
Right. This is a very interesting enterprise. It's called Studio X, and it's in Istanbul, right along the bank of the Bosphorus, the European bank of the Bosphorus. And it's run in conjunction with Columbia University. And this is a new sort of research exhibition space that is sort of dedicated to answering and tackling the most pressing questions of urbanism. This particular exhibition is called Compressed Guantanamos, and it's a worldwide exhibition looking at the state of prisons or the question of prisons around the world. The one talk that I was able to attend focused on a prison in the east of Turkey in a city called Diyarbakir. Right after the 1980 coup d'etat, it was the most notorious prison in Turkey. And what a set of researchers have done is they've put together what they call the first unofficial truth commission in Turkey. These people have gone to the to Diyarbakir, where the prison was, and they've managed to interview 500 of the 7,000 people that were imprisoned after the 1980 coup. And it paints a absolutely horrifying and depressing picture of what went on there. This was a prison that was not designed to incarcerate or to punish, but it was, in the words of the people researching, it was a showcase for how torture can be used to suppress an identity. This is not torture to get information. This is not an interrogation. This is torture to suppress the Kurdish identity. And like I said at the start, this is a gallery. This is happening in a gallery. This is not happening in a lecture hall at a university. This is happening in an exhibition hall, a public space that is ostensibly a gallery. And these places are really taking on this task, which is a very, very key task in Turkey.
Just in the interest of time, and before we just go on to our last theme, but I wonder how has this been covered in the Turkish media? You know, if I went to the culture pages of the Hurriyet, Caleb, would I have seen the story? Did it get significant play?
Yes, it does get significant play. This is one of the things that the media is able to do to cover things like this. They're not able to do their own investigative research or investigative journalism per se. There is, of course, some, but not to this degree. But covering it is done, and it does make an impact.
Just before we go, there's an exhibition by Rubin Murray, Lebanese artist, and this is focusing on the Civil War. So a very curious exhibition to be running at this time, and I guess, again, just the pitch of it, because across the border here you have a country which is completely unraveling and being leveled. So is this a cautionary tale from Lebanon? The timing is a very curious one.
It is, and it's the one of the most impressive parts of that exhibition is a lecture. It's a video installation in which Rabi gives a lecture, basically, to the viewer about a play that he wrote and produced about a suicide bombing that happened during the Lebanese Civil War. And he was saying that he wrote and produced the play prior to the September 11th terrorist attack in New York. And what he did was, because this was about a suicide bombing written before the September 11th attacks, he eventually stopped producing or performing the play because he found journalists were using it and applying it to the narrative of the day, which was Islamic fundamentalist terror, whereas he was talking about left-wing terror, extreme left terror in Lebanon. And so it's a very interesting question that you have about timing, because he would probably say, let's not apply this to Syria, let's keep this about what it was, which was Lebanon. But at the same time, anyone going to it in Istanbul, which, as you said, is right across the border from Syria, will be hard-pressed not to make that connection.
Caleb Lauer in Istanbul, thanks very much as ever for those cultural insights. We're almost at the end of the show. We're back right after this. And indeed, that's all the time we have for this very special edition of Midori House on this Easter Monday. Many thanks in particular to our special guests, Dr. James Boyes and John Everard, and of course, Caleb Lauer in Istanbul. Today's show was produced by Alla John, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Janie Cho, and our studio manager is Mr. Alex Funnell. Next up is Culture with Rob Bound, who's presenting us with a show all about new beginnings and asks why the new culture minister for the Serbian government has brought in graffiti artists to decorate his office.
Not only interesting because we're painting something very unusual and done for the first time. Another first time thing is some of us have never worked together. So in a way, it's going to be an experiment and a challenge.
I bet. The show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's sleep tight if you're listening in Asia. It's good evening if you're in Europe, and it's a good afternoon if you're in the Americas. But for me, Tyler Berlay, it's goodbye. Thank you.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.